You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, February 13th, 2026. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. Announcement before we start today's episode, Rabble has updated our Patreon. This is a project that the team has been wanting to take on for a while now, and we're so excited to be launching it today with you. Joining Rabble.ca on Patreon means a lot of great things, including access to exclusive content and interviews from our writers, community polls, recorded webinars of special series, and, drumroll please, bonus episodes of Rabble Radio. Supporting Rabble on Patreon starts at just $1 a month and supports the work we do as independent journalists. So head over there to join us on Patreon if you love Rabble Radio and want to hear even more of it. And now, on with the episode. This week on Rabble Radio, we present something a little different from our usual offerings. Today, we'll be sharing the harrowing love story of Rachel Durie and Nilo Edwards. If those names sound familiar, you may have read headlines about the wife who donated her kidney to save her husband. But the headline only captures a fraction of what they lived through. Earlier this month, Sarah Sahagian sat down with Rachel Durie to talk about falling in love at 18, becoming a living organ donor, and what it means to keep going after losing the love of your life. This is part one of this story. Here are Sarah and Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for being here today.
Hey, happy to be here.
So why don't you start by just telling me a little bit about yourself?
My name is Rachel Durie. I born and raised in the Toronto area, went to Queens with you. That's how we met. Spent some time working in Ottawa, did the whole Parliament Hill political staffer thing. And in that period of time when I was still in university and then moving to Ottawa afterwards, I met my husband, Nilo, who was also an equal political nerd, little overzealous early 20-something-year-old wanting to change the world. And after a few years in Ottawa, where we were became thoroughly jaded by the whole process, we moved across the country to Vancouver. And so I've been in Vancouver for about 13 years now. Spent some after the Hill, spent time working for Nilo. He was in the Indigenous resource sector, investments. And he passed away a year ago, a little over a year ago. And so now my whole life has been moving from politics, resources into medical philanthropy in his memory. I've moved into the nonprofit space now that I wanted a whole change of life, a change outside of his network, and started doing my own thing. So now I'm a little nonprofit warrior.
Tell us about how you met Nilo. So I had the privilege of watching your romance, but tell our listeners how you met him and what it was like when you just came into each other's lives as teens.
We met at 18 years old, which is wild. We were introduced by a mutual friend of Sarah's and mine, who we lived with in our little Queens house, Kelly Murdoch. It was funny because, you know, you get to residence first night there and you're trying to do little games to get to know each other. And so we had to do this bingo card and we had to find somebody who was in the same program as us. And so Kelly and I were both at Queens to study politics or political studies. And in our very first conversation, she mentioned this friend of hers who was already in Ottawa, already working on Parliament Hill. And then about 2 weeks later, after I'd spent more time with Kelly, she's like, you know what? I think you should meet my friend. And I think it's probably because we were the only two conservatives she knew of, which is why she's like, oh, you must be a match. And so it was 2005. And so Nilo and I did the classic thing you do in 2005, which is we started chatting on MSN Messenger, if we can all remember that, which then turned to telephone calls. And then eventually I took the bus, the Greyhound bus from Kingston to Ottawa and went and met him in person. And honestly, I think we were a little bit crazy. It was instant. We knew we were going to get married within weeks of starting to talk on the phone. And we were very serious. We got engaged a year later at 19. We got married at 21 between third and fourth year of undergrad, which is now when I look back, absolutely insane. we knew right away, having no idea what our future would hold for us, but there was an intensity and a seriousness, and it just, something in the back of both of our minds said, we don't have a hell of a lot of time. And we dove in full, all in. Yeah.
That Tell was me about us. The proposal.
Oh. Again, back to us being little political nerds. So, so Nilo tricked me. Our proposal was a complete surprise, even though we had talked about getting married. I certainly didn't expect the ring to come when I was 19, but it did. We got engaged in September of 2006. So that'll be 20 years this fall, which is wild. And he had told me that Stephen Harper's cabinet was going to have a cabinet retreat the weekend in Kingston. It was close enough to Ottawa. They're all going to drive down via the little convention center on the water. And as part of that, there was going to be a dinner for community members, but it was invite only. And of course, I believed this because this is the kind of thing that would happen. And so I was all dressed up going to this, expecting to go to this little political reception. He was in his suit. He picked me up, drove me to the waterfront where the convention center is. And of course, there are no lights on in this building. There's no people around. I was like, what is going on? And he got me out of the car. I was like, I don't think there's an event. He's like, well, there isn't, but tonight is still a special night. And he led me to a bench on the water and got, actually, did he get down on one knee? I don't think he did, but sat next to me. I have no idea what he said. I couldn't tell you, but he pulled out the ring. I said yes at some point. He put it on my finger. And then we went to the Keg in Kingston to have some wine, prawn cocktail, table next to us, overheard, could see the smiles. And that table bought us some wine. Restaurant gave us the prawn cocktails. And it was so sweet and so innocent. And then, of course, I came home. You weren't there. I think you were on a debating weekend and I didn't tell you the next day. Kelly was home.
And it was so funny because you kind of surprised me because you were asking about my trip and I was telling you the detail and I was telling you some sort of like salacious gossip. I forget. I mean, by the standards of the day, right?
Right.
And then you whipped out your finger and told me Nilo proposed. So I was also surprised that weekend and it was such a joyous moment. I was so happy for you guys. I'd never had a friend who'd gotten engaged before. And so,
we were 19. No, we should be getting engaged.
We were so young. But it's funny because I'd always grown up being told you should get married older. And I believe that for myself, but I never had any doubts about you guys. I always thought that it was a sensible decision for the two of you, that it really made me believe that two people could just be soulmates. And it didn't really matter when you got married because you would always be right for each other.
So and we were, and it was instant. Yeah.
Instant. Exactly. So tell me about your time in Ottawa, because you said that you got a little bit jaded. And I'm just wondering, you guys were a like progressive conservative, more like that kind of that would be how I would describe you. How would you describe yourselves back then?
Yes, I would say maybe a little more right-leaning than progressive at the time, but we're so young. And for myself, I lived in a house where I had everything I wanted. I'd never had any real experience, no hardship. I went from this little safe suburb of Toronto to Ottawa. I didn't understand the rest of the country. I didn't understand how different it was. And so, yes, I was learning about politics. And I remember the first time I went to visit Nilo's family, he was from a little tiny island off of northern Vancouver Island. And his family were fishermen, or are fishermen, and loggers. Very different than my background. And I remember sitting at his grandparents' kitchen table, looking out at the ocean, and his grandfather was going on about how the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, DFO, in Ottawa doesn't get the plight of the local fishermen. I remember sitting there going, whoa, regionalism is real. This isn't just a theory in my textbook. And so then, you know, you take this safe life, you take these theories, and then you get to Ottawa and start seeing how things are actually done or aren't done. And then you're growing up and you're meeting more people and you're traveling to other parts of the country and realizing that, man, this conservative side of, I'm still right-leaning, I would say. I'm not a member of any political party anymore, but it's like, oh, this tough on crime where mandatory minimum sentences all the time. It's like, well, actually, let's look what led to that. What were the social issues in this person's childhood? It's, or, you know, whatever the issue was, it was just understanding that everything isn't so black and white, and that people across all parties have perspectives that are valuable. And so it was understanding or realizing that this team consensus wasn't there, and that it was just too partisan, I think, for me, and too black and white. And the answer, what you think it is usually a lot more complex. And we need to be more open-minded and have a larger conversation as a nation, considering different regions, different ethnic, linguistic backgrounds. Just, it needs to be, our country's diverse, so let's bring our ideas together and have diversity of thought. And it was, that wasn't happening. And that's why we wanted to leave and just do something else.
Why don't you tell us about what you guys did when you went to BC and how you changed your careers and the field that Nilo and you ended up in?
Absolutely. Well, Nilo's didn't change too much because he had been working for Senator Jerry St. Germain, who was chair of the Standing Committee on Aboriginal Peoples. And so it was through that committee work that Nilo really saw the struggles of our Indigenous nations around the country and how they need help. They need clean drinking water. They need housing. They need roads. And so, again, being right-leaning, it wasn't just, okay, let's just hand out money from the government that our government increasingly doesn't have, but it's how can we actually empower and allow these nations to have their own source revenue. And then it's not just about money, but when you are in charge of your own revenue, then you need your own strong systems of government and community and leadership and everything that else goes to support it. And so it was really he wanted to empower nations or help. He wasn't doing the empowering, just helping them to do it themselves so that they could be completely self-sustaining and self-governing and not have to rely on Ottawa. Nilo, I said, grew up in northern Vancouver Island. On this little island, wasn't a reserve. He was born in Alert Bay, which was a reserve. But as a white man, he had a very similar upbringing where there are no economic opportunities, where education isn't valued, where there's a lot of addiction and struggles. And so he overcame that himself just through a lot of grit and hard work, but realized systemically these nations, these rural parts of our country, cannot do it without economic opportunities in the region. And so it was his own upbringing, the work in the Senate committee, and then just, again, growing up and realizing it's not, oh, just go get a job. Well, you have to have something for there to be a job for somebody to do. And so it was just, he had this huge heart and wanted to fix the system by changing the system so people could be fully in control of their own future and not just asking the government for money.
And so what was the name of the organization where he was the CEO for several years?
Yeah, so he actually was the founder of this organization. It is called the First Nations Major Projects Coalition. And so he started that when we moved out to BC in 2013. He was working for the First Nations Financial Management Board. And it was about a year into that work where he was hearing from nations that there was a need. Because right now, if somebody wants to put a pipeline, you know, across the country, they go nation to nation individually negotiating a deal, and everybody's under NDA. So you don't know what your neighbor next door got, which leads to a lot of infighting. And so it was like, wait a minute, we're actually strong together. And so let's get all the nations that this pipeline is going through to come together to the negotiation table and say, no, it's one deal for everybody. We would like equity stake. So we, the nations, are going to buy a portion of this project, and we are going to be sitting on the board of the project. We're going to be in leadership positions, and there's going to be job opportunities for our youth and mentorship. And so that's the name of the organization. That's the mandate of it. It started in our bedroom, in our little tiny condo, and it has grown. They have a project portfolio worth $45 billion. I forget how many nations, hundreds of nations across the country. It's every province, coast to coast to coast. And yeah, it's an unbelievable force. It's not just the project work. They've done a lot of policy work, and the federal loan guarantee for Indigenous natural resource projects was Nilo's work. That took 10 years of pounding on the door in Ottawa to get this change made. And then in April of 2024, Chrystia Freeland, who was our federal finance minister at the time, stood on stage at Nilo's conference in Toronto at the Sheraton Centre and announced the federal loan guarantee program, which allows First Nations, because right now, if a First Nation wants financing to purchase a part of a pipeline coming through their nation, that's reserve land. They can't go into a bank and get a reasonable rate of financing. So now the federal government is going to back that, and the nation can get reasonable rates that somebody else would be able to get. And so they can now purchase a part, be a part of the planning, the organization, the long-term funding.
Let's talk a little bit about Nilo, not in a professional capacity, but let's just talk about what happened when he got sick the first time. So he was running this organization. He was a really busy professional, and then he got sick. So I know it's going to be hard, but can you just describe a little bit of what that was like?
Absolutely. So this was in 2018, again, so early days of the First Nations Major Projects Coalition, FNMPC. And Nilo was traveling across the country, changing time zones. I mean, Canada is huge geographically, right? So he's changing multiple time zones a week. And just, I mean, anybody's going to be exhausted by that. Mm-hmm. And we thought that he had like a flu or a cold, just he couldn't shake this. There was something there, really burnt out. And so it was end of June, getting more tired. This weird cough came. It also happened to be our 10-year wedding anniversary. And so we went to San Francisco for this trip, thinking this will be the answer. Take a few days off work, have some naps, have some relaxation. He'd be good to go. Trip didn't go so great. Nilo spent most of the time in bed napping, or when we were walking around the hills of San Francisco trying to go out and about and enjoy the trip, he had to keep taking breaks and he was sweating. And I was like, I don't know if you know too much about consulting work, which is what he was doing. They party pretty hard, those boys. It's late hours, lots of drinking, it's lots of dinners out. And so I remember standing on a corner in San Francisco as he's like trying to get his breath. I'm like, you don't exercise enough. You're like, you need to drink less. You need to go to bed on time, you and your friends. And I'm just yelling at the poor guy. He's like, yeah, I guess I need to go to the gym. And so we got home from that trip. He, of course, went away for another couple of days, but it was when he was away, he was up past 2.5 hours northeast of Prince George, so pretty far north of British Columbia. He was like, oh, this isn't good. Flew home, and as he was trying to walk from the gate at YVR to his cab, he thought he was going to faint, and that's when he realized this might be more than the flu. That was a Thursday in July, Thursday, July 12th, 2018. The next day he went in to see our GP. Our GP was away, so it was a locum. And she was like, yeah, you know what? You probably are burnt out. You're a young guy, but you travel a lot. I'll just send you for some blood work just to be 100% sure, but you probably just need a longer vacation. He went for blood work that afternoon. And that night, the doctor called that the blood work was back and it didn't look so good. Nilo's phone rang. She called 5 times before he actually picked up. His phone was in his pocket. He saw it coming in, but he was too afraid to pick up. I didn't know his phone had been ringing all evening. And it was finally at about 9 o'clock at night on Friday, July 13th, 2018, that he finally picked up the phone. And the doctor said, you need to go to the emergency room immediately. And we didn't know what was wrong. She said, you can't drive. Your wife has to take you. Just go. And it's like, what do you mean? What is happening here? And so we dropped everything. We get to the emergency room. I didn't even know where the emergency room was at VGH. I dropped him on the sidewalk, found some parking, went in. They did some more blood work and we were sitting in the waiting room and we knew it wasn't good because it wasn't a nurse who came out to get him. It was the white coat, the attending in the ER. And I remember hearing Mr. Edwards and he puts up his hand and she goes, do you have anybody with you today? And he said, my wife. He said, could she goes, could you both come with me? We need to talk privately. And I remember standing up and just feeling like the floor fell out from underneath me, going through the sliding doors into the chaos of a Vancouver emergency department on a Friday night. These were early days of the fentanyl crisis. It was a wild emergency department. And she sat, there was nowhere to sit. So she sat us on a gurney with our back to the nurse's station. And I remember she said, tell me, like, is there something going on with your kidneys? Do you have kidney disease? He's like, what? No. And she's like, okay, well, I'm going to send you for an ultrasound and a couple of other things. We're going to just take a look. And she didn't say anything to scare us. And so Nilo was ushered away for his ultrasound. And again, my back is to the nurse's station. And this is when I heard it for the first time. We're now about 1:30 or 2 in the morning at this point. And she picks up the phone and all I hear her say is, you need to come down here now. I've got a young guy in acute kidney failure and I don't know why. And that was the first time I heard it. Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And that started us on to a very intense and crazy journey.
And so when did you find out that Nilo would need a kidney donation?
Right. So what that blood work showed that we hadn't been told is that Nilo had 15% kidney function. And kidney disease or kidney failure is people don't tend to be symptomatic until they've lost about 80% of their kidney function. So it really is a silent killer. So we didn't know why Nilo was in kidney failure that night, but that night the nephrologist did say, this could be an infection and we'll just give you a bunch of antibiotics and you'll be good to go in a couple of days. Or this could be an autoimmune situation. We have to do a biopsy and we'll find out. So Friday he went into hospital. We found out on Tuesday that it was an autoimmune disease. And it was that Tuesday they started talking transplant might be an option for him, but they really didn't know. It was early days. I would say it was October, so 3 months later, that they said, okay, for sure, he will need a transplant. But again, they had no idea how long it could take. They said you could need a transplant in a month, you could need a transplant in 10 years. We really don't know. He was officially sent to the transplant clinic in March of 2020. And so the funny thing is, I think that was Thursday, March 12th, 2020. It was World Kidney Day. That was the day we were told, yep, time to plan for the transplant. 3 days later, or over that weekend, the world shut down. And on Monday, nobody was allowed to get tested to be his donor. Everything was shut down. So now we're sitting there in this pandemic that we're terrified of, knowing he needs a transplant. They had told us the transplant in March of 2020, they told us the transplant was likely needed in December of 2020. And now we're going, okay, nobody's allowed to get tested to find out if they're a match. The program is shut down and you're telling me in months this guy's going to need a new kidney. So again, it was just more intense terror.
And tell me about that miraculous moment when you found out that you were actually a match for Nilo and that you could give him one of your kidneys.
It didn't happen as excitingly as I would have hoped or expected it to happen. So, as soon as Nilo got sick in 2018, I wanted to do anything for him. So he was diagnosed with a very rare 1 in a million person autoimmune disease called antiglobular membrane basement disorder, or anti-GBM is easier to say. And again, it's a 1 in a million person disease. They have no idea what causes it. Their hypothesis is environmental factors because they're seeing an uptick of cases on bad forest fire years. And of course, living in Vancouver, we every summer get inundated with this forest fire smoke. And Nilo was traveling to all these rural parts of the country, so breathing this in frequently. We don't know if that's what caused it. And so right from the beginning, like if I could have snapped my fingers and traded places with him and taken on the full burden of his illness, I mean, that's all I wanted to do. And so as soon as they started talking about him needing a transplant, I was like, amazing. Finally, I can do something for this man, right? And so we were told on the Thursday of 2020, time to start finding a donor. And when you are looking for a kidney transplant, if you are not on dialysis yet, it is up to you to find your own donor. And it is best to find a living donor. So if until you start dialysis, nobody helps you find somebody. You have to do all the solicitation yourself, asking people, putting your name out there, putting your story out there. It is on you. No help. And so, of course, I'm going to do this. I'm the first person who's going to do it. I filled out a little paperwork on the Friday, again, another Friday the 13th. I went for some blood work. And then on the Monday, that's when the transplant clinic called and said, great, you're healthy enough based on the paperwork. We can start assessing you for transplant, but the program shut down. So we'll get back to you. They opened it up in June of 2020. And so I did my assessments through the spring and summer. It was September of 2020. I got a phone call that said, okay, great. We're going to move you to the next set of evaluations. I was like, perfect. And so I'm back and forth on the phone with the coordinator at the hospital, getting my final appointments booked. And those appointments include a meeting with the surgeon and a meeting with the transplant nephrologist. And we've been on the phone a few times. And I said, hey, I'm just kind of wondering, when am I going to know if I'm a direct match for Nilo, or am I still being evaluated to go into the paired exchange program, which is a national program that if I really wanted to donate to Nilo, but I wasn't a match for him, and there was another pair over here who they really want to donate, but they're not a match, but we can swap. And so I would donate to person A, so person B would donate to C, and they do this whole web across the country. So I was like, am I still in that, or is it Nilo? And the coordinator goes, what? Nobody told you? Like, nobody told me what? She was like, oh, just a second. And here, click, 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 ruffle, ruffle, ruffle. And she goes, yeah, you're his match. I was like, what? What do you mean? She's like, yeah, you're a match. And I was so confused by this moment. So I get off the phone and Nilo comes into the kitchen doing stuff. He had his head in the fridge. And I was like, I'm your match. And he's like, and I remember kind of pulling his head out going, what? And I was like, I think I'm your kidney match. I'm going to give you a kidney. And we were both kind of confused by this. And so there wasn't a big moment of relief or tears or a hug. We're just kind of like, this is confusing, but cool, I guess. So it was not what I thought that moment would be, but it was still really sweet in its own way.
This was part one of Rachel and Nilo's story. Sarah and Rachel's full conversation will be available on Rabble's Patreon, and it is well worth the listen. 20 minutes is simply not long enough to contain the full scope of what these two meant to each other. The link to listen on Patreon can be found in the show notes of this episode. To consider and learn more about becoming an organ donor yourself, visit the Canadian Blood Services website to find your province's specific registration link. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. To help support our show, please visit rabble.ca/donate, subscribe to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and now join us over on Patreon for special bonus content. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.